Welcome to the MedTech Talk Podcast. This is your host, Jeff Pardo, and for this month's episode, I'm delighted to have Connor Hanley, CEO of FHIR1, joining us. For the past 20 years, Connor's been on the forefront of bringing new medical technologies into the home and empowering patients to take charge of their health. Today, we're going to explore what it was like growing up in Ireland, his path into MedTech, and his leadership of companies like BiancaMed and FHIR1. Connor, welcome to the podcast.
Jeff, it's great to be invited on, a real honor and privilege. Thank you.
Well, you know, to get us started, I'd love to hear a little bit about growing up in Ireland. It was in the 80s, which I know was a particularly difficult time for the country. I mean, you know, especially as we view the country now, which seems to me to be incredibly vibrant, but it was a little different back in the 80s. What was it like in that era?
Well, the first thing I'll say, Jeff, you must be looking at my LinkedIn photo, because if you think I grew up in the 80s, I'm a lot older. That's an old photo. So I actually born just in the late 60s, but the 80s was probably my formative time, just as kind of in secondary school, high school, I think is how you call it in America. Mm-hmm. And it really was quite a bleak place economically. I would say we had about over 18% unemployment. When I graduated university in 1990, I was an engineer. Most of my class, I'd say over 90%, emigrated. Wow. Primarily to America and some to the UK. So it was quite great fun. I have such fond memories. Growing up, a very happy time, but from the prospects of economic activity, it was pretty bleak.
Yeah. And nonetheless, your father was an entrepreneur, I think, as you've told me. What were the things that he was doing, and you know, as you grew up?
So before I go there, I'll probably step back. I think you're trying to ask me what kind of made me think through going into the entrepreneurial environment. And I think if I was thinking of what influenced me, I'd probably go back to kind of a story my parents told me. And I think it's true because we have the photos to prove it. So my parents were, I'm a result of a marriage across the big divide in Ireland in the late 50s, early 60s, across the religious divide, across the cultural divide. And my mother swears that my father asked her to marry him within the first half an hour, even though they're both dating other people.
Wow.
And we have a photo of that evening. And the reason I bring it up is if you think of entrepreneurship at all, certainly I always think the dream is so important, the hope over experience. And I think that story has stuck in my psyche very early on. And they headed off to America straight afterwards because it was really not a done thing. It was kind of the dream over the status quo. And I think America really influenced my parents. At that stage, when they left in 1962, I don't think Ireland was fully electrified. Mm. And when they went to America, like everyone had the white goods in the home, the fridges, driving down the freeway. They went down Route 66. So somehow that American dream probably got bedded into me growing up in Ireland. So that's just why I kind of went off on a slight tangent there.
Yeah.
I think it's an important aspect. But my father came back to Ireland. My mother dragged him back because she thought it was a great place to raise children. And I think my father came back kicking and screaming because Ireland still was quite parochial, like in the 70s, still quite economically depressed. But he got involved, and I was kind of a partner in an engineering firm. So entrepreneurship and driving his own company was fundamental to his kind of motivation for work. And I kind of look at the opportunities in Ireland now, and I just think my father would wish he was here driving on a business at this stage.
Yeah. And you yourself started working at a young age. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So I think this is linked to my father's view of trying to go out to the workforce, trying to make your own way. I think at 13, I think was the age, I was packed my bag and went over and went for a job in France, probably to learn French, but I wasn't quite sure what to do. But I ended up getting a job as an au pair, looking after children. But what was amusing was, I think when the parents saw my inability to look after kids at a young age, I immediately got a promotion, or maybe it was a demotion, to be a gardener. So I did that for a bit of the summer. And then I also sold ice cream. But I think it was just the encouragement of trying to go out and stand on my own 2 feet. I was encouraged at an early age. I'm not sure if it'd be legal now, actually. But anyway.
That must have been quite an experience. Were you a better gardener than au pair?
I think the ice cream selling was more my forte, which probably was more relevant to trying to raise funds.
Now, you yourself then, I mean, if we fast forward a little bit, also went into engineering and also, you know, came to America. Maybe describe that period of your life.
So I was attracted by science in secondary school, and maybe it was the influence of my parents kind of leaning towards the engineering, but it was really kind of attracted to try to make an impact with technology. So I did chemical engineering in UCD, which is one of the larger universities in Ireland. And I graduated in 1990. And as I mentioned, there was huge unemployment, about 18%. And I hadn't really thought through my next phase of my career. I hadn't really thought about a job, and none of them really seemed to attract me. There was what we call a milk round here, where large companies come and try to hire people, and there wasn't that many opportunities. So I went and actually got a scholarship to do a PhD in University of Pennsylvania. So I went to do that. Wasn't sure if I was going to stay to do a PhD. I think I was doing a master's, but I think I just got slightly obsessed with the technology and spent the 5 years doing a PhD there. It was very interesting. I was focused on trying to make thin layers for gas transport out of dope molecules, try to mimic the cell membrane. So it was pretty interesting. But I sometimes wonder if I should have looked up more. At that stage, I think Netscape has just been starting, the whole internet, and I was so focused on my PhD. So it's interesting how you can get quite focused, yet there's so much changing in the world. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Jeff. You probably were studying at the similar time.
Oh, no, I'm much younger than you, Connor. No, I also kind of bypassed the whole digital, you know, internet boom of that era. And funny enough, I mean, I was, the first job I had was in oil and gas, and I know that your first job was really also in chemicals, right? And you were on the forefront of of the change.
I got a job in chemical engineering. There's kind of a well-trodden route into kind of oil, gas, and I actually joined a very large company called Air Products, which is its main product is actually separating air into oxygen, nitrogen, and all the other components. And I did a few roles for them. They had a career development program, sort of trying to expose you to many different opportunities over your first 3 years. But some of the opportunities were fabulous. So one job I had, which I'm pretty sure when people ask me about what I've done, I think it resonates most with people, is we were putting the nitrogen into beer to get the great foam on top of a beer. And that was a very entertaining job. You have to drop a bit of liquid nitrogen into the can or the bottle before it's sealed, and then it's pasteurized. And if you get your calculations wrong or chewed up the equipment incorrectly, you get a lot of micro explosions in the pasteurizer. And unfortunately, then someone would have to drink the waste.
Now, was there a particular beer that that you were working on? Or was it the Irish Guinness, or was it an American beer?
So we actually started in... So Guinness actually probably invented this nitrogen aspirate foam. We applied it in the UK, but we were trying to transfer it into the Belgian beer market. And it was fascinating to see some of these microbreweries and really thinking through, no matter how great an idea the nitrogen was and the different presentation, the master brewers were so focused on any change in taste or any change in presentation that it didn't quite take off. But it was a fascinating experience, and I obviously have to try to learn how to sell French. As you might have realized, I'm not linguistically very gifted. My Irish accent is the same, whether it's in English, French, Spanish, or any other language you can care to think of. So that certainly can cause quite a bit of laughter in any other language.
Yeah, absolutely. And coming off of that, you know, one of the things I love about your background is how many different things you've done, you know, prior to getting into healthcare. And I know one of the experiences was was really getting into sort of the electronic paper, but in that process, kind of reflecting on what you really wanted to do. And in particular, this is when you started thinking about healthcare and sustainability, I think, and the aging demographics. Yeah. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this transformation.
Just prior to that, with that large chemical company, Air Products, I had one role that really triggered my imagination. Mm-hmm. Air Products was the largest hydrogen producer in the world. So in the mid-90s, we launched the first hydrogen fuel cell car in London. It's funny looking back at it now, just how much kind of the electronic vehicles and Tesla has taken off. Ours looked like a golf cart, but something around the purpose of that activity really kind of, I don't know, motivated me. And it also showed the importance of timing, thinking through innovation. So I left then and I'd been an engineer probably through education and career. And I think I needed to broaden my language because I did want to make an impact with innovation and technology. So I went and did an MBA in France. I think in 2000, 2001, it's funny, it was prior to 9/11 and the world definitely looked a lot rosier. And then when we graduated, 9/11 happened, the dot-com bust had come true. Mm-hmm. But I really had in the back of my mind about having more purpose. And I also had met my wife at that time. We weren't married and I was very focused on really trying to see if I could persuade her to marry me. So I actually came back to Ireland at that stage in 24. I'd been away for 11 years. So I came back in about 2001 and I could not believe how much it had changed. So I left in 1990, 18% unemployment, mm-hmm. came back in 2001 and the economy was still in the throes of what's called the Celtic Tiger. I think we were one of the fastest growing economies for 10 years in a trot globally. Mm-hmm. It was just astonishing and just amazing. So I joined a company doing electronic paper. We literally had a flexible plastic that looked like what the Kindle looked like. But I met the Amazon people very early on as they were doing the Kindle and the ebook. We did not win that race, but it just showed me kind of the importance of technology and timing. And it was like an MBA on steroids, how much I learned from a young company that had raised quite a bit of money. But through that time, I wanted to go back to having more purpose. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to look at sustainability, but I got quite obsessed with the transition that was coming at us with aging demographics mm-hmm. and the intersection of ICT. And I really started looking at health tech. And that's when I knew one of the engineers who was a professor in UCD, is the local university here. And another researcher, Philip de Chazelle, and we ended up co-founding a company called BianchiMed, and was very much on the purpose of this transition of the hospital to the home, aging demographics, the empowerment of ICT. So that was in 2003, 2004. So we were certainly, I would say, early on in this whole phase of empowering people with their data, thinking through wellness and that whole continuum into chronic disease. Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on any of that, Jeff? It's pretty early.
Yeah, you're very early on. I mean, we're still really talking about how to make that work in the home, and maybe describe a little bit more about BianchiMed and specifically what you were doing there.
So my two colleagues were expert signal processing. I realize now they should have been called a bit of AI engineers. Mm-hmm. So they were excellent at biomedical signal processing, and they had developed a lot of expertise around the heart rate and how much you could extract information from the heart rate and variability of it. But as we kind of brainstormed of how to really unlock it, we were wondering how to make it more powerful for people in their home. So we actually licensed in a technology, which was a small radar. It's what your car uses when it's reversing and it goes beep, 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 beep. Mm-hmm. So we packaged that small radar, which was very low cost, and put on top the software analysis. And we had a really quite a phenomenal breathing monitor and a sleep monitor. And we were certainly not lacking in ambition, maybe even naive. So I think we were less than 20 people. And we launched a consumer product in the Apple stores for sleep improvement. And then we launched with a partner, Omron, in Japan, a sleep apnea product for diagnosis off the shelf. And in parallel, we were doing two chronic disease monitoring by monitoring respiratory parameters around COPD and heart failure to see if we could predict a hospitalization in advance of it happening.
Yeah, obviously very relevant and challenges that are still being worked through today. And in particular, back then, you know, this was, you know, 2008, 2009. This was a really tough time in the whole venture market, and you were raising money at the time. And how did you get through that? That must have been quite challenging.
That was some journey. So yeah, no, that was a tough period for fundraising. I think I had at least 100 face-to-face visits with at least 100 no's. I'm not sure how I got through it. I think I kept coming back. First of all, the team is so important. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to counterbalance each other. And for me, I keep going back to the purpose of what we're trying to do and the excitement on the potential to help people. And I think that gives a bit of a compass. I also was pretty confident we were onto something. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd eventually find an investor that would see the dream. And fortunately, we did.
Yes. Yeah, who was that?
That resilience is always quite interesting. And I wonder, is it the lack of sunshine in Ireland that gives you a bit of a comparative advantage? I'm always envious when I go to California. Does the sunshine make you more optimistic? But maybe the unpredictability of the weather here just makes you, the sun might come out tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it just keeps you going.
Yeah, I totally agree. That happened. That's a mentality in Boston as well. I think there are a lot of similarities. So what happened? Who was that investor that saw the promise that you did?
We had brought on one investor, DFJ ePlanet. I think they were this very impressive global fund. I think Elon Musk had been part of the same group. I'm sure we were just the rounding error. And then we brought on a group based in Paris called Saventure, mm-hmm. who were very focused on connected health. And I'll continue the story, but they are actually part of the syndicate now with FireOne. Mm. But just at that time, we were making great progress, and we were just about to raise another round, and we were starting to get interest from strategics, and we got acquired by a company called ResMed. Do you know ResMed, Jeff?
Oh, I know ResMed, yes, very well.
So they're an amazing company. So originated in Australia. I think they're approximately 30 years old. Market cap over 30 billion. The founder, Peter Farrell, is still chair. And it's really been an entrepreneurial journey. They provide ventilation support, CPAP, for sleep apnea. And part of the reason they acquired us was they were thinking through strategically two areas. One is how to empower people as consumers as well as patients. And we had been looking at this consumer aspect of sleep. And secondly, they were looking at this whole transition of smartening up with connected smart devices. And they had a presence mm-hmm. in so many millions of homes. So they acquired us and another company called Umbian. I think it was part of their whole transition as they went more patient consumer friendly and really unlocking the potential of data. I think it's one of the most connected life science company in the world still.
Yeah.
And it's really gone from strength to strength. And a very entrepreneurial company.
Yeah.
And a great experience for me because it's so different coming from a very, I say, small ship in big oceans, which is what it was like in BiancaMed, mm-hmm. where you have a dream, but you don't have quite the resources to deliver on it, to a very large company that has great expertise and insight into the market. That whole change in process and the importance of it, and a much bigger team. There's pluses and minuses. It'd be interesting to hear your views on that difference between a small company and a large company.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I mean, and particularly coming from your background where you had probably a lot of flexibility in what you were doing, how you were doing it at BiancaMed. I started at Synthes, which was a small company, even though it was, you know, probably a mid-sized to larger company by the time I joined. But there was still a lot of entrepreneurship within Synthes. So it didn't feel as much like a big company, but what was that transition like for you going from where you were leading something and now you're fitting into just a bigger, you know, corporate culture? Did that feel constraining to you or were you just able to take a lot from that experience as well?
It was a learning. The first thing I would say, I think during the acquisition, ResMed really understood the talent inside BiancaMed. And it's probably a comment, as I see now, that the whole Irish ecosystem has really had a very impressive track record over the last 30 years in manufacturing, quality of engineering, R&D. And I'll probably come back to that when we talk about Fire One. So the whole team actually got acquired inside ResMed, and they used it as a foundation to build out their presence in Ireland as an operating service company. For me personally, I was very fortunate to get a number of promotions. So I really was getting exposure to some of the strategic decisions ResMed was making. I was reporting up to the CEO, and I ran their new ventures business and also the global cardiology business unit. I think the real one of, first of all, the talent was so deep. The insight and knowledge of the market was so deep. The process they applied was great. But in a young company, you're so committed to driving your innovation forward. In a large company, there's such an opportunity cost of any money you take away from the core business and the timeline of quarterly reporting. It was quite, quite a lesson for me about how challenging it is to really step out of the core in a very large listed public company.
And is that, was that what, you know, made you think, well, now's the time to, you know, really look for something else, to look for kind of the second act on the in terms of entrepreneurship?
I hadn't really scratched the itch in chronic disease, and I was still living in Ireland and traveling like crazy. And the Foundry team came knocking on my door. And the more I met them, the more fascinated I became. My wife thought I was a lunatic, thinking of even going back into a young company. But I really couldn't get out of just the excitement of trying to drive forward an innovation and kind of continue the journey I probably had started at BiancaMed. And I don't know if you met Mark and Hansen, but they're remarkably persuasive. And and just a great vision of what they were trying to do, an amazing syndicate that they had already started. And this was their first company they had set up outside the US. So it was quite exciting time for me, just interacting with them and watching as they try to bring their expertise from Menlo Park and the Foundry into innovation. And in parallel, they, so when we were the first kind of, I would say, in inverted commas, Irish employees of Fire One. And my two colleagues, John Britton and Fearchris Sweeney, joined, I think, the same month. So we came on as kind of three musketeers. So at least there was a kind of a momentum going pretty much from the get-go.
And what was it about what they were doing that, that was so compelling to you?
So if I step back and just look at how relevant heart failure is to people, and one in five is going to suffer from it, it's such a huge cost on society, both kind of on an individual personal basis. It's a pretty miserable disease to have, but also economically and hospitalization. I just go, there has to be a better way. And even the word heart failure is kind of depressing. And I was probably thinking, how can we use a good insight into kind of empowering physicians and patients to really just try to change the trajectory? And I think in the interim, since the days of BiancaMed, I've been fascinated by the growth in Dexcom and how they have transformed probably the standard of care for patients suffering with type 1 diabetes, making it kind of consumer-oriented, empowering, data displayed under the guidance of a physician. And I think really it's been a real example of how to maybe transform chronic disease. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. Like, it really is such an important aspect as we all age, aging demographics, that if we can change the trajectory of chronic disease, it's just very motivational. Gets me up on a Monday morning. In, wet January.
Yeah. And I think I think you touch on something that's really fascinating, because when you think of chronic disease, I mean, there's obviously underlying components for patients that are suffering from chronic disease. Could be genetics, could be, you know, socioeconomics, could be a range of different things. But there are at the root of it, you know, choices that patients make every day, which can, you know, can make a difference in their chronic disease. And that's where I think you talk about empowering the patient with data and getting them to change their behavior. And I wonder, I mean, what's fascinating about Fire One, I think, is it's both, you know, a very traditional kind of medical device technology, and maybe you can describe that a little bit. But as you say, it's also a very patient interfacing technology, where you need to take a lot of what I'm sure you learned at BiancaMed and ResMed and put that into action. But how difficult was it to develop both an implant and that sort of patient-facing technology?
So the concept coming out of the foundry was heart failure is fundamentally, because the heart is not pumping sufficiently, the body adapts by retaining blood volume. Mm-hmm. And the insight from Mark, Damon, Hansen was, if you're going to try to manage blood volume, you should measure where most of the blood volume is. And they said on the venous side, 70% of it is where the blood is stored. So they immediately focused on the inferior vena cava, which is the largest vein to bring all the blood back to the heart. It's a very supple vessel. And the focus was, how do we get a sensor to measure the volume of that vein that's safe, reliable? So that was a big focus as we started. And we literally started with pretty much a blank page. And we had three parallel technologies we brought to the preclinical stage. And that's the team kind of led by Firka and Stephen Sheridan. And we brought it all to preclinical and actually had an objective criteria to select one. But it really was a needs-led innovation. Mm-hmm. So that actually kind of got the foundation of actually trying to measure what the intravascular volume was. And then that's only starting the journey, because then you have to link in all the software, the compliance, the product to make it as easy to use for the patient. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure of many other places in the world where you could have the expertise to actually employ them as part of the team. You need medical device experience, you need quality, you need regulatory, you need manufacturing, and you need software. And Ireland is just such an amazing hub, and it's all been probably the transformation since the 80s. Quite a number of the major medical companies and software companies from America has come and set up here. So people are well-trained, experienced. It really is a phenomenal group to try to do it, but it's hard. You're doing probably three or four products at once to really bring a very nice solution to patients to empower them.
Yeah. Yeah, and you and I had a recent breakfast in a very spirited debate when I made the mistake of saying, how compliant can patients really be? I thought you were going to come across the table at me. but I, you know, it's a funny thing, you know, with venture capitalists, we talk about patient compliance, or there's certain things that, you know, aren't, I would say, saying it's the third rail is probably too much of an extreme, but it's thought of as a big challenge, is getting patients to change behavior, getting patients to comply. And I think you had a very different view of it.
I think we underestimate people. Like, I think you have to think of it, we're all patients are going to be. And I think the empowerment of your data might give you the nudge. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, Jeff, you're trying to make fun of me, because I think I revealed I have a little hobby, which is having Cheerios at night with my son.
which is
non-compliant. And since the grief you've given me about that particular topic, I have nearly weaned myself off that habit, Jeff. So you see, compliance, even for a dinosaur like me, is possible.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. But I think upon reflection, I really agree. I mean, I think, particularly with conditions where, you know, it's not always totally obvious what's happening with the patient. You know, I think of COPD where, you know, they might feel fine, but they have the beginnings of what could be an exacerbation, or same thing with heart failure. And if you give the patients that advanced warning, then they know what the end result is if they don't address it. So I think you make a really good point about the power of people to sort of change their trajectory.
I'm also just even talking to the patients on our clinical trial. Mm-hmm. I think the sense of engagement and empowerment, it's so motivating listening that they feel they're taking control of a condition that until now had kind of nearly been a jail sentence for them, or a death sentence, being told you have heart failure, and now they feel a bit more empowered. I think as what's happened in type 1 diabetes with Dexcom, I think this unlocking of data and feeling more in control, I think really is helpful,
yeah,
living with these conditions.
Yeah.
I just need to hurry up before I get too old and have it myself.
Well, we're fortunate we can treat our own conditions in our business. Now there are attempts to do this today as we think about CardioMEMS and other companies that are trying to that do it via measuring atrial pressure. But talk about why measuring volume in the vein is potentially better than measuring pressure.
If I step back, it's such a big challenge trying to maybe think about heart failure and how to do better outcomes for patients and the whole healthcare system. People have tried many different things. At the moment, when you have overloaded with blood volume, you usually take a diuretic to help you pee to pass the extra blood volume. And people have tried weighing scales. They've tried a lot of the non-invasive symptom-based. Mm-hmm. But to date, all those attempts have been very good for maybe risk stratification, which tells you that if you're getting sick, the symptoms may change, but they haven't been able to show a change in an outcome in a random control trial. The solution to date that has been very interesting is a company called CardioMEMS that has an implant in the pulmonary artery. And there they have tried to use the increase in pressure in the pulmonary artery as an indication of volume overload, and then ask the physician or the clinical center to reach out to the patient to adjust the diuretics. The clinical data has been really excellent, but unfortunately, it hasn't taken off as much as people hoped. And one of the primary reasons for that is it just ends up overloading the clinical center with the data tsunami. And our focus has been very much, if you get a more direct measurement of blood volume that's very early and sensitive and very specific for the individual, we actually can have a titration point where the physician can say to the patient how to adjust their diuretics. So most of the adjustments happen in the home by the patient, similar to what happens with Dexcom with type 1 diabetes, and removes the workload, but also empowers the patient. And I think it's quite transformative to help patients. I think the experience with CardioMEMS has, this system can have a great impact. It just hasn't taken off thinking through the whole workflow aspect.
Yeah, that's such a powerful comparison. I mean, you think about what would happen if, the doctor had to, for diabetic patients, be involved in kind of every, alert, or, it wouldn't work. The system couldn't work. It really does take the patient to be the one really interfacing with the technology, at least as a first line. And I think that is tremendously promising. So you're involved in a clinical trial, and maybe even just anecdotally, can you share any examples from the clinical trial of the impact that it's starting to have on these patients?
We haven't. So we're just preparing for our pivotal. So everything I say is anecdotal. So I think we need to do a proper random control trial. But we did release some data in March at THT. Mm-hmm. And the physicians are extremely excited, I think, about the safety, the potential usability, and the physiological foundation on our solution, on really having a very early sensitive signal. I think it's watch this space as we continue to release data, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, that's exciting. So of course, any project like this, you're going to need to raise a significant amount of capital. And I should say, as maybe not a disclaimer, but just as Information Guild is an investor, my partner Janka Dittmer has been very involved with you. But I wonder if you could talk about, raising capital, maybe even in comparison to when you're at BiancaMed raising capital to now raising capital for Fire One. Have there been differences? What have you learned along the way? And what are some of the lessons you would share you've been through very tough times. You've also been able to raise now substantial amount of money. So what have been some of the lessons learned in that path?
So they're varied. So the first comment is just on the macro environment. I think the area we're looking at, which is connected health, has come more of age. Mm-hmm. And I think that backdrop very much helps. So I'd say the vision and the timing is a very important context mm-hmm. on what you're presenting. You have to be, I think, generally ahead of the curve. You're innovating and doing a young, growing company. The second thing is, if I look at where we based it, so both BiancaMed and FireOne are headquartered in Ireland, just how much has changed in 20 years, just the breadth of investors who are interested in being exposed to opportunities in Ireland has really been transformed. Mm. And I think it's been a very intentioned vision on some of the government agencies here on making sure global international investors realize what's happening in Ireland and are interested in learning more. And I think critical, I know it might sound a cliche, but the team is everything. And just the breadth of experience here for the project we're trying to do that's cut across standard medical devices, software, quality, regulatory, manufacturing. It really is an amazing place to, I can't think of a better place in the world to actually do the type of product we're offering. Mm. So FireOne is an order of magnitude bigger than what BiancaMed is, as it was, just in size of ambition, capability, and our focus. So I really would probably, what I self-reflect, it really is the importance of the team and focusing on the patient about how to help them and maybe thinking big enough or ambitiously enough that people will rally around and go through the hard times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well said. You mentioned something earlier, which I found interesting was, you know, Mark and Hansen kind of brought, you know, sort of a West Coast, you know, a way of doing things into FireOne. Obviously, there's a, you know, the Irish influence, as you've been talking about, is very significant. You also have European investors from the France and the Netherlands, and you're bringing together lots of different sort of cultures and viewpoints in this. I wonder if you could comment a little bit about that and how that's worked in practice.
Well, the first comment, I think, just about our industry is just how capable people are. Mm-hmm. And usually when I go into a room or a meeting, I usually assume I'm the least capable there. Just the depth of experience from the investors and our advisors and the team. And I think that's an important aspect of just as a FireOne group that we always kind of listen to the input, digest it, and then think about how we're setting our direction or modifying it. And on the cultural aspect, which I'm not sure if that's where you're asking on difference between US and Europe. Yeah. Go on, Jeff.
I was going to say the difference, but also how it's come together, you know, and worked within FireOne. Yeah.
So one aspect about being in Ireland and in Europe, I think we have a great medical device industry. I think we are very attuned to a lot of the regulatory aspects from Europe, but I think the whole market has transformed from where people used to do their first in human and their early clinical trials to get CE marking in Europe to this pendulum of the opportunity in America, which seems still the biggest healthcare market, the most attractive for and interested in new innovation. So this combination of making sure you have a very strong foundation with devices, manufacturing, software, but focused on the commercial opportunity in the US is something we're trying to continuously bridge in FireOne. And one challenge about being in a small country like Ireland, the benefits are it's very well networked. The negatives are it's a very small market. Mm-hmm. So we need to continuously travel to make sure we're exposed to all the nuances. And actually having investors from both sides of the Atlantic really help to make sure we're keeping current.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What has been, you know, one of the things that's really impressed me about you over the years is, you know, you are like a sponge for information. And just as you're saying now, traveling, I mean, you and I have met many times in our office. I can imagine you utilize your board frequently to make sure you're thinking about things, as in an expansive way as possible. If you could talk a little bit about that, I often find that CEOs don't know how to utilize their board. They use them more in a reporting function, or, you know, they don't really know that this is like a free resource, and not only the boards, but the whole partnerships that surround these companies. And it seems to me you just naturally are very open to seeking out advice and feedback.
Well, first of all, I think I like people. So that's my first comment. So I enjoy meeting people mm-hmm. and I enjoy listening and hearing different views. But I'm also very conscious Ireland is such a small country. We need exposure to what's happening in America. We need kind of the experience in Europe. Like, it's such a resource. We have a relatively well-sized board, and we have a lot of advisors who have got quite interested in our progress and want to be engaged. I nearly think of it as one large team. There's obviously full-time employees, but I kind of think of it as layers of all one part of a team of the consultants, the advisors, the board. And I think people want to help. It's an amazing industry. People want to give guidance. And it's a complicated industry with the regulation, the reimbursement, clinical recruitment. People want to help each other. It's, I think everyone's motivated by doing better care. And it's such big markets, I don't think people feel particularly competitive.
Yeah.
So I think that helps people share information and be supportive.
Yeah.
It's a very small industry. I met Yank, I think, from Gilday when he worked with Philips, when I pitched him in Bianca. Mm. It's a small industry here. You're going to keep meeting people.
I really agree. And I agree. It's as you mentioned, it's very collegial, which has been, you know, one of the really nice aspects of our business. But one thing I could see is if you know at the one side you're very open to new views and different views, but at the end of the day you still have to be the one leading. You still have to be the one making the decision. How do you balance that between, you know, assimilating information from different perspectives, but then taking a position? Is that challenging?
Of course it is, and I'm part of a team as part of that process. I've just got a great group where we kind of share and explore things and challenge each other. Sineva, Fergus, John Britton, we just really focus on things. So I challenge myself a lot internally. The other aspect is I try to make sure I have a good kind of, I would say in inverted commas, moral authority of meeting clinicians. Mm-hmm. And trying to meet patients and really going back to why I'm in it at all, which is thinking through to how to help patients. And I think that gives a good compass as you set through the priorities on what you're trying to do. And thinking that the patient could be myself, could be my mother, and what would be relevant and what would I like if I was suffering from heart failure. And that gives you a certain compass to think through the trade-offs, because it's such a tension. Mm. Between incremental innovation, does it get you on the journey to prove a stepping stone, or do you need to go further into the dream to make sure you can unlock the market and make it attractive both for the patients and investors? And that's a tension, and you have to get a lot of input around that trade-offs.
Yeah, I think that sounds so key to me, and you know, keeping the patient and the doctor and the kind of the problem you're solving and the impact you're making kind of front and center seems like a very unifying, you know, a unifying way to go about it. And one of the questions I was going to ask you is, you know, when you are in a company that needs to raise money across many different rounds of investment, how do you keep all the investors on the same page? Because, you know, over time there can be misalignment. I'm curious if there's anything you've kind of learned in keeping everybody, you know, rowing in the same direction.
So it's always a journey, I would say. But one thing, I try to keep coming back to the vision mm-hmm. and the purpose of what we're trying to do. And also I try to listen a lot to the feedback. I think if people feel listened to, mm-hmm. they can be part of a process and can get in behind something that they might not initially always agree with, but think that, yes, for the company, we should drive it forward. So I think the listening perspective and responding to the feedback is a very important aspect, but also being clear on where the company should be going. I think the investors, the team, the board all want to see that direction. Mm-hmm. And I have an amazing group of people I'm working with, and that really helps as well.
Yeah.
But also part of the reason I do travel a lot, Jeff, is I think communication is not always just over Zoom. I think you have to meet people. Mm. I have to build up trust and talk about my Cheerios obsession at night. It kind of ends up making you explore things in a different direction.
Well, I am amazed, because every time I'm at a conference, undoubtedly I turn the corner and there you are.
That sounds like a bad penny. And Jeff, I hate to say it, I think you're not the only person to say that to me.
You know, one thing I want to end on, and because it's been fascinating to hear about, Ireland and the growth and development of Ireland during your kind of growth and development, and it's just incredible the transformation since what you described in the 80s to now. How did Ireland do it? I mean, it really should serve as a model, I think, for other countries looking to really change the, you know, change the economy, change the way of life. What did Ireland do so well?
So I'm not an economist, but just at first glance, kind of thinking about Ireland and my experience of it. First of all, the country definitely had huge economic hurdles with such high unemployment and such emigration, which is a real tragedy for a country when people have to emigrate. And I think it made great alignment between private industry, the government, all the different companies about that something different needed to happen. Then I think everyone aligned that we needed great jobs and need to generate economic activity. And in parallel, Ireland has always been obsessed about education. Mm-hmm. So we're extremely well educated on any number of attendance in universities, degrees at a strong participation in education to quite a late stage, masters, PhDs, etc. And then there was a real focus on, we need employment. And this is back in the, before the 90s. There was a focus on seeing if we could bring in kind of high value industries that needed a lot of people. We were English speaking. We joined Europe, EU in the early 70s. So we had access to a large market. And I think our corporate tax regime attracted a lot of multinationals, particularly American companies, coming to access the European market, have a well-educated, very low-cost workforce. And there was high income tax, so the government still could actually capture some of the tax from income here to put it back into society and keep society together. Mm-hmm. So I think it's multifactorial, but it's English-speaking, highly educated, very, very business-friendly, and realizing it's a small country with an open, we have to be open. Economy have to be business friendly, have to export. Mm-hmm. But it's been an amazing transformation.
Well, Connor, this has been really an enjoyable discussion, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do it, and learned a lot as always, and really it was a pleasure.
Jeff, thanks for the honor and privilege, and I look forward to hopefully see you in Ireland for a change rather than meeting you in Boston.
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks, Connor.